It's time to tell our side of the story, but we need your help. Please share, like, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening to it. And please, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. It helps us beat the big tech algorithm. Also, if you love Red Pilled America, please consider becoming a Backstage subscriber. For as little as $5 a month, you'll have access to our entire back catalog of episodes and our behind-the-scenes podcast. Just visit redpilledamerica.com and click support in the top menu. That's redpilledamerica.com and click support in the top menu. Support what you love or it goes away.
Previously on Red Pilled America. So why did it take roughly 40 years for BLM to rise from the ashes of the Black Power movement?
I'm going to start right now to inform white people of what they don't know.
Alex Haley was a 41-year-old black columnist that happened to be in the right place at the right time.
They would talk about the self-same thing. It was a long narrative history of a family.
He titled it Roots. Slavery had never been shown in such a brutal light on primetime television. The only problem was, it was a complete fabrication.
Roots introduced whites to the black oppression narrative and opened the doors to that narrative being a staple in America's cultural institutions. I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show. This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks.
Stories about everyday Americans that the elites ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth. Welcome to Red Pilled America.
That Red Pilled America is the only storytelling show of its kind? It's true. We are the only storytelling show that acts as an antidote to the Marxist indoctrination currently infecting every cultural institution in America. Film, literature, academia, art, music, television. We've been doing the show for close to 2 years, and the only reason we're still here is thanks to the support of our listeners. You are our lifeline. Without your support, we do not survive. Please consider supporting Red Pilled America by visiting our website at redpilledamerica.com and clicking support in the top right menu. You can make a one-time donation, purchase some of our Made in the USA merchandise, or maybe become a Backstage subscriber. For as little as $5 a month, you'll get access to our entire archive of episodes and our behind-the-scenes podcast. Support what you love, or it goes away.
So this is the fourth and final part of Hands Up, our series of episodes delving into the origin of Black Lives Matter to figure out where it came from and what it wants. You don't need to have heard the last three episodes to understand this one, but in case you missed them, in part one we looked at how BLM came into national prominence by telling the story of the death of Michael Brown. In part two, we dug into the true origin of BLM by telling the story of its predecessor, the Black Power Movement, and how it planted in the minds of African Americans the idea that the police are the enemy. In part three, we looked into how the victim narrative, the main ingredient fueling Black Lives Matter, made its way into every cultural institution in America by telling the story of Alex Haley's miniseries, Roots. Before the 1970s, discussions of the darkest aspects of slavery were largely muted in America. But that all changed in 1977 with the broadcast of Roots, a 12-hour, 8-part miniseries that to this day is one of the most watched TV broadcasts of all time. Roots told the true story of its author, Alex Haley's family, from the capture and enslavement of his African ancestor, Kunta Kinte, his voyage to America, and his family's long, tortured journey to freedom. The miniseries portrayed a brutal depiction of slavery and became a cultural phenomenon. Roots was used as a tool to teach American history in public schools at all levels. But not long after the show garnered 130 million viewers, investigative journalists began finding egregious historical errors and outright fabrications. In the end, most historians concluded that Roots was a complete work of fiction, a fraud. However, the damage had already been done. Roots showed the power of the oppression narrative, and Black Power Movement sympathizers in every American cultural institution used it to brainwash a generation of citizens that blacks were victims of systemic racism. stories saturated with victim narratives flooded the big screen, television, literature, and school curriculum. This victim narrative entered America's operating system in the disguise of fancy-sounding titles like Critical Race Theory and Chief Diversity Officer, and bred an entire crop of citizens to believe America was racist at its core. Once this victim narrative entered our cultural institutions, it slowly corrupted the entire American experience. Like an arsonist secretly opening a home's gas line, the toxic ideology of oppression slowly filled every space of our culture, and it was waiting for someone to strike a match to expose just how thoroughly the victim narrative had saturated America. And that match came on May 25th, 2020.
Moments ago, the chief of police in Minneapolis announced that he had fired four police officers involved in the arrest and subsequent death of a black man in police custody. George Floyd repeatedly told the officers that he could not breathe after an officer knelt on his neck, pinning him to the ground during an arrest. A bystander captured yesterday's incident on a cell phone camera.
The death of George Floyd triggered an insurrection that quickly engulfed America with the agents of chaos all chanting one phrase.
Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter!
We now know the true origin of the BLM movement and how it swept through America. But what does it want? What is the goal of Black Lives Matter? The answer can be found in the story of its primary ringleader, a man who entered the national spotlight during the 2012 election cycle. What he pulled off could go down as one of the most consequential hoaxes in modern history, and we'd never know about it if it weren't for a filmmaker named Joel Gilbert.
On February 26, 2012, George Zimmerman, a 26-year-old Hispanic, was driving to his Sanford, Florida home when he noticed someone wandering through his neighborhood in the rain. The area had experienced a string of break-ins, so Zimmerman decided to call the Sanford Police non-emergency line to report the suspicious character.
Sanford Police Department, line is being recorded, Sean.
Hey, we've had some break-ins in my neighborhood, and there's a real suspicious guy. It's Retreat View Circle. The best address I can give you is 111 Retreat View Circle. This guy looks like he's up to no good, or he's on drugs or something. It's raining, and he's just walking around looking about.
Okay, and this guy, is he white, black, or Hispanic?
He looks black.
Did you see what he was wearing?
Yeah, a dark hoodie, like a gray hoodie, and either jeans or sweatpants and white tennis shoes. He's here now. He was just staring.
Oh, he's just walking around the area?
Looking at all the houses.
Okay.
Now he's just staring at me.
He's near the clubhouse right now?
Yeah, now he's coming towards me.
Okay.
He's got his hand in his waistband. And he's a black male.
Okay. How old would you say he looks?
He's got a button on his shirt. Late teens.
Late teens, okay.
Something's wrong with him. Yeah. He's coming to check me out. He's got something in his hands. I don't know what his deal is.
Okay, just let me know if he does anything, okay?
Officer over here.
Yeah, we got him on the way. Just let me know if this guy does anything else.
Okay. These assholes, they always get away. Shit, he's running.
He's running? Which way is he running?
Down towards the other entrance of the neighborhood.
Okay, which entrance is that he's heading towards?
The back entrance.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
Okay.
All right, sir, what is your name?
George. He ran.
All right, George, what's your last name?
Zimmerman.
All right, George, we do have him on the way. Do you want to meet with the officer when they get out there?
Yeah.
All right, where are you going to meet with him at?
Oh, crap, I don't want to give it out loud. I don't know where this kid is.
Okay, do you want to just meet with him right near the mailboxes, then?
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, George, I'll let him know to meet you with you out there.
Actually, okay? could you have him call me and I'll tell him where I'm at?
Okay, yeah, that's no problem.
Zimmerman got off the phone anticipating that the police would arrive shortly. A few minutes later, another resident from the area called 911, frantic about a fight that had broken out just outside her door. A fight that could be heard in the background of the call.
911, do you need police, fire, medical?
Maybe both, I'm not sure. There's just someone screaming outside.
And is it a male or female?
It sounds like a male.
And you don't know why?
I don't know why. I think they're yelling help, but I don't know. send someone quick, please. Yeah.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right, what is your...
There's gunshots.
You just heard gunshots?
Yes.
How many?
Just one.
When it was over, a 17-year-old black male was dead. When police arrived just a few minutes later, they found Zimmerman waiting. His face was bloody, as was the back of his head. His nose looked broken, and an officer noticed signs that he'd been on his back.
What, if anything, did you notice about the condition of his jacket?
The back of it was wetter than the front of it, and it was also covered in grass.
Zimmerman told the officers that the person laying dead on the ground had sucker punched him in the nose and began pummeling him to the point where he feared for his life. In a move of self-defense, Zimmerman said he shot him with his legally registered firearm hidden below his waist belt. The officers handcuffed Zimmerman and took him to the station for questioning. He was later released, and on the following day, Zimmerman met with officers at the scene of the tragic incident to walk them through what happened.
Right here, right in front of this house.
Okay. Right in front of 1460?
Yes, sir. I left for the grocery store, and I just felt like something was off about him.
Right.
So I said, and there's been a history of break-ins in that building, and I called previously about this house.
Right.
Sanford police continued their investigation. They took statements from a few people that saw parts of the fight. Still listed as a John Doe, they began looking for the identity of the deceased. They eventually realized that someone had called into 911 that night reporting their son was missing.
I also need to file a missing person report because it hasn't really been 24 hours. I'm from Miami, and my son's up here with me, and he left. We don't know anybody up here.
And you said it was your son that's missing?
Yes.
And you said, how long has he been missing for?
Since last night.
How old is your son?
He's 17.
Okay, what's his name?
Trayvon Martin.
The caller eventually identified the kid. The investigator played for the mourning father a recording of the 911 call with the man wailing in the background.
I don't know why I think they're yelling help, but I don't know. Just send someone quick. Say, stop.
Is that your son yelling for help? The officer asked Trayvon's father. He responded, no. Ultimately, after reviewing everything, including both Zimmerman and Trayvon's injuries, Sanford police decided that all of the evidence corroborated George Zimmerman's story. He shot and killed Trayvon in self-defense. The next night, local media ran with the story on the shooting.
New tonight, a deadly shooting in Sanford. Police have the gun. They've got the shooter, but they have not arrested him. And as Fox 35's Keith Landry tells us, the dead man's grieving family wants to know why not.
Sanford police still trying to figure out exactly what happened in this spot here last night. We talked to a man who didn't want to be shown on camera, who witnessed part of the attack right here, then went upstairs to his window and witnessed the rest of it after he called 911. What are you thinking now about all this?
This afternoon, I talked to John through his front door about what he saw last night during a fight that turned into a deadly shooting.
The guy on the bottom, who I believe had a red sweater on, was yelling to me, help, help. I told him to stop, and I was calling 911.
John locked his patio door, ran upstairs, and heard at least one gunshot.
And then when I got upstairs and looked down, the person that was on top beating up the other guy was the one laying in the grass, and I believe he was dead at that point.
The parents of Trayvon Martin were not happy with what they were hearing from the Sanford Police Department, so they contacted a man named Benjamin Crump.
My phone was buzzing. I was over in Jacksonville, Florida.
Benjamin Crump was a personal injury lawyer that had made a name for himself in the black community of Florida.
Strange things happen to black people when they're in police custody.
About 6 years before Trayvon Martin's death, Benjamin Crump was connected to a high-profile case involving the death of a black teenager at a unique juvenile detention facility known as a boot camp.
Sergeant David Krull is about to unleash a roar of discipline. It's 5 in the morning and the start of a long day for 19 juvenile offenders at a Panama City, Florida boot camp.
These juvenile boot camps were a lot like they sounded, military-style, strict-disciplined prisons for youth offenders that were, in essence, a last-ditch effort to scare them straight.
We will break them down, physically and mentally.
You can run! You can run!
And then try to build them up by telling them how well they're doing.
Back straight! Back straight! You can get up!
This boot camp is the last chance for troubled teenagers. They're young, multiple offenders, on the verge of hardcore prison time.
In January 2006, a 14-year-old kid died at one of these facilities on his first day in camp. The kid, Martin Lee Anderson, complained of breathing problems during a running exercise and wanted to stop. Guards thought the boy was faking his symptoms, a practice they claim was common among the inmates. So they forcibly pressured him into continuing the exercise, at one point administering ammonia tablets under his nose to shock him into compliance. When his body continued to stay limp, the guards, including a nurse who was standing by the entire time, went into emergency mode, eventually rushing him to receive medical care. To everyone's surprise, Martin Lee Anderson was pronounced dead shortly after. It was a mystery. So they performed an autopsy, and it showed that he died due to complications from sickle cell trait, a blood disorder common in Black people. An investigation into the matter found that the guards and nurse were not culpable and that no criminal charges would be filed. Dissatisfied, the family hired attorney, Benjamin Kremp, who demanded that surveillance videos of the detention center be released. The videotape showed the guards manhandling the youth until they realized he was in distress. None of their fist blows to his arms or legs looked remotely lethal, but the video images were enough for Benjamin Kremp to work his magic. He embarked on a media blitz suggesting the young Black man was killed because of the color of his skin.
If this had been you, if this had been I, who did those things to a child, I am 100% sure that we would be sitting in a prison right now. What makes the police and the government officials above the law? Is it because Martin Anderson was a poor Black boy?
One of the primary guards was in fact Black, but that didn't matter to Crump. He used the videotapes to rally students from his alma mater to protest for the guards and nurses to be prosecuted. Crump also enlisted so-called civil rights activists Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson to help pressure local officials.
We were watching the Super Bowl together, and they argued about a touchdown. And the way they resolved the argument is they went to the videotape. We come to Florida today to tell the governor, let's go to the tape.
The public pressure worked, and the state quickly agreed to what at the time was a record settlement of $5 million. Securing a quick settlement before the trial even started was a stroke of genius by Crump, because evidence would eventually come out during the trial that exonerated the guards and the nurse. In rare cases, rigorous exercise can be lethal for those with sickle cell trait. The boot camp facility knew this, so through their admission forms, they specifically asked parents and guardians of those being detained whether the child had the condition. Martin Lee Anderson's parents failed to notify the detention center that their son had sickle cell trait.
Would you be surprised to know that he actually was tested for sickle cell trait as a young man?
I was surprised. I would not be surprised.
Wouldn't be surprised at all, would you?
Not at all.
Did you ask anybody in the family if he had been tested?
Again, I go back to the history. Tell you the process, what I'm telling.
Who did you get the history from?
From the mother.
From the mother?
Yes.
And that's because you were relying upon the answers from the mother of the child, right?
Yes, sir.
And you were assuming you could trust the mother of the child to tell you the truth, right?
Absolutely.
And to relay to you accurate information about the child.
Absolutely.
So you assumed that if the mother didn't tell you you had sickle cell, you could believe her.
Absolutely.
You could rely upon that.
Sure.
Ultimately, the defense attorneys proved, without a reasonable doubt, that the child died due to this condition, and if the parents had informed the facility, Martin Lee Anderson would be alive today.
You reviewed those medical screening documents, hadn't you?
Yes, I did.
And all those documents specifically ask about sickle cell, don't they?
They do.
They're on there for a reason, aren't they?
I suppose they are, yes.
And it would have been real nice for that nurse to know, wouldn't it?
Would have been good for her to bring out any pertinent information.
It would have been good for the nurse, and it would have been good for the instructors, wouldn't it?
If the information would mean something to them.
And it would have been good for Martin Anderson, wouldn't it?
If they had been in a position to realize the implications of sickle cell trait, in an environment with dehydration and exertion and restraint and suffocation.
In fact, it could have meant the difference between life and death in this situation, couldn't it, Mr. Adams?
Yes.
The guards and nurse were ultimately found not guilty. Benjamin Crump, in a scene that would become familiar in the coming years, stood with the parents and blasted their exoneration.
You kill a dog, you go to jail, you kill a little black boy. Nothing happens.
Nevertheless, through the whole affair, Benjamin Crump developed a model for securing big bucks from the death of a black person at the hands of law enforcement, even when the fault of that death resided with his clients.
It's always the same formula.
That's Joel Gilbert, author and filmmaker of The Trayvon Hoax, Unmasking the Witness Fraud That Divided America. Through his work on this book and accompanying documentary, Joel became accustomed to Benjamin Crump's method.
Ben Crump shows up and says, you can't believe the police investigation that exonerated because they can't be trusted, and give me a ton of money, and here's a list of political demands from my allies in the media and the Democrat Party, and you got to make all these political changes. The media just accepts whatever story Crump puts forward and runs with it, and anybody that tries to present evidence otherwise is just ignored completely.
But the kicker comes later.
What happens is, a year later when it goes to court, the person gets exonerated, we find out that everything we were told at the beginning by Crump and by the media repeating his story was false.
This is the playbook that Benjamin Crump put into action when he was contacted by the parents of Trayvon Martin just 2 days after their son's death in February 2012. Crump started by enlisting Al Sharpton.
When Attorney Crump called me, I told him, I don't believe in drive-by activism. If we in it, we gonna be in it till we in and win.
On March 16th, 2012, a little over 2.5 weeks after Trayvon Martin's death, Crump held a press conference. He presented two witnesses that heard but did not see the altercation between George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. One of them adamantly pitched to the media that George Zimmerman was the aggressor.
We are here with these individuals who bravely came forward after making several attempts to contact the Sanford Police Department to tell them what they saw on the night that Trayvon Martin was killed.
My point is that I feel it was not self-defense because I heard the crying, and if it was Zimmerman that was crying, Zimmerman would have continued crying after the shot went off.
The assertion was ridiculous. Of course George Zimmerman would have stopped yelling for help after shooting Trayvon Martin, because Trayvon was no longer punching him in the face. The media didn't push the witness on the claim. They ran with the story unchecked. As his hook sunk deeper into the willing media's cheek, Benjamin Crump amplified his calls for Zimmerman to be arrested. The Sanford Police lead investigator responded to Crump's press conference, saying, quote, "The best evidence we have is the testimony of George Zimmerman, and he says the decedent was the primary aggressor in the whole event. Everything I have is adding up to what he says," end quote. The investigator knew that Zimmerman had all of the signs of being the one that was beaten. He had a broken nose, cut on the back of the head, and the autopsy would later report something that the Sanford Police Department already knew. Trayvon Martin had two injuries, a gunshot wound to the chest and broken skin on his knuckles. George Zimmerman was yelling because Trayvon Martin was beating his face in. Feeling the pressure from Benjamin Crump's media blitz, the police released the 911 calls.
What do you need, police, fire, or medical?
Police, I just heard a shot right behind my house.
He just said he shot him. Yes, the person is dead, laying on the grass.
Just because he's laying on the ground.
Oh, my God.
Crump's efforts were moving the needle, but they weren't leading to an arrest of George Zimmerman. And that, of course, was of paramount importance to the Trayvon Martin camp for more reasons than one. You see, without Zimmerman's imminent arrest, extracting money from one of Benjamin Crump's targets would be difficult. Zimmerman was listed by his homeowners association as a contact related to the neighborhood watch. If Crump could convince the HOA that their neighborhood watch contact was going to be arrested for the death of Trayvon, Crump could force the HOA to agree to a large settlement before the case went to trial, just like he did in the Martin Lee Anderson case. But the problem for Crump was the police were holding to their position that there was no evidence that conflicted with Zimmerman's version of the events. That's when the personal injury lawyer pulled a rabbit out of his hat and he called a press conference. Again, Joel Gilbert.
Benjamin Crump came up with a phone witness, someone he said was on the phone with Trayvon Martin.
On the phone precisely at the time Trayvon and Zimmerman met face to face.
Her testimony that's shown on these phone logs connects the dots, completely connects the dots of this whole thing. This young lady details it completely, the tone of the conversation and the nature of the conversation and what was happening the last minutes of his life. Now, I will ask you, her parents does not in any way want to reveal her identity. She is a minor. Her parents are very worried about her. She is traumatized over this. This was her really, really close personal friend. They were dating. She is traumatized beyond anything that you could imagine. And we all were teenagers, so we can imagine how that is when you think somebody is really special in your teenage years, you call it puppy love or whatever you want to call it, and then suddenly and tragically it's taken away and you have, unfortunately, a firsthand account of it. So I will ask you again on behalf of the family and on behalf of the young lady's family, if you would please respect their privacy. She is a minor.
Crump then introduced a recording of Dee Dee, Trayvon's girlfriend.
And presented her statements on a recorded interview in which she simply repeated his media narrative that contradicted all the evidence and the eyewitnesses.
We're giving this to the Justice Department. We're going to play. Jeff.
Trayvon, I'm wrong for it. And then the man, and then he said he knocked the man, and then the man come, and then Trayvon said the man still was following him.
Much of Crump's recording was hard to hear, but Dee Dee's general message was that it was actually George Zimmerman who was the aggressor that initiated the fight with Trayvon Martin. It's here where Benjamin Crump revealed his playbook to a national audience.
The dots have all been connected. Arrest George Zimmerman for the killing of Trayvon Martin in cold blood today. Arrest this killer. He killed this child in cold blood. Right now, he is free as a jaybird. He's allowed to go and come as he please while Trayvon Martin is in a grave. This person who shot their son, this Neighborhood Watch Homeowners Association, Loose Cannon, who killed their son, will be brought to justice. He will be arrested, prosecuted, and convicted. We'll not stop, we will not rest until he is arrested.
Dee Dee's grainy recording was the only piece of evidence that contradicted Zimmerman's account, and it kept the campaign to get him arrested alive. As expected, the media ate it up. Benjamin Crump made the rounds to the Today Show, Court TV, ABC News, and others, arguing that Trayvon Martin's 16-year-old girlfriend was the proof needed to arrest George Zimmerman.
Mr. Crump, though, as an attorney, does it worry you that really what this is hearsay evidence?
It really doesn't, because she is a 16-year-old teenager who just lost a person very special to her. Her parents are very concerned. They did not want her to get involved. And it wasn't until Mr. Martin found the phone records and saw that she called him at 7:12. The police got on the scene 7:17. He was shot and dead on the ground.
The chilling words of Martin's 16-year-old girlfriend, who phone logs show was on the phone with him in the seconds before his death. ABC News was right there exclusively as Martin's family attorney questioned her about that night. We now know police have the call logs, but never called her.
The media played its part in helping Crump, even running with the fake narrative that George Zimmerman uttered a racial slur during his call to the police on that tragic night. To ramp up the racial element even further, the media positioned the Hispanic George Zimmerman as a white man.
It's the story that's ignited fierce passions across the nation as allegations of racism and miscarriage of justice tear apart a small Florida town. 3 weeks ago, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed black teenager, was shot down by a white neighborhood watchman who claimed self-defense and has not at this point been arrested.
At one point, NBC News deceptively altered Zimmerman's call to the police to make it look as if he targeted Trayvon because he was black. They'd later have to apologize. The story got so hot that Obama spoke out.
But my main message is to the parents of Trayvon Martin. You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon.
Crump's media blitz was working. On that same day, Florida announced they were appointing a special prosecutor to look into the case. George Zimmerman's Homeowners Association was no doubt feeling the pressure as media began speculating on a lawsuit.
Law enforcement probes the shooting of Trayvon Martin here in Sanford. There's growing concern a civil lawsuit will take place regardless of whether criminal charges are ever filed.
You better believe it's 100% guaranteed there's going to be a civil lawsuit.
Attorney Justin Clark represents condo and HOA residents and says the target of the lawsuit would likely be the retreat at Twin Lakes Homeowners Association, with the claim being that the association be held liable for Martin's death at the hands of George Zimmerman.
Local law enforcement were feeling the heat as well. Their initial position was that based on the evidence, they would not arrest Zimmerman.
In this case, Mr. Zimmerman has made the statement of self-defense. Until we can establish probable cause to dispute that, we don't have the grounds to arrest him.
But as the Sanford police chief spoke, Benjamin Crump was helping investigators secure a statement from Trayvon Martin's girlfriend. Dee Dee made a sworn statement that during her phone call with Trayvon, she heard George Zimmerman was the aggressor. That was exactly what the special prosecutor needed to charge George Zimmerman with murder. His arrest was imminent. Benjamin Crump was now in the position he'd been working towards. Within days, Crump announced a settlement with George Zimmerman's HOA. Benjamin Crump got what he was fighting for, a reported seven-figure settlement. Just a few days later, the special prosecutor announced charges against George Zimmerman.
Today, we filed an information charging George Zimmerman with murder in the second degree. A capias has been issued for his arrest. I want to especially thank Mr. Crump.
The special prosecutor in the case has charged 28-year-old George Zimmerman with second-degree murder. Conviction on that charge could carry a maximum penalty of life in prison.
There was no question about it. George Zimmerman was arrested on the testimony of Benjamin Crump's surprise witness, Trayvon Martin's 16-year-old girlfriend, Dee Dee. It was the only new development in the case. But as the months passed, something strange began to happen, and ultimately, it would lead to perhaps one of the biggest courtroom hoaxes in American history. More after the break.
Welcome back. So George Zimmerman was arrested, but as the trial approached, something strange began to happen. Benjamin Crump refused to provide a copy of his interview with Trayvon's 16-year-old girlfriend, the one he used to argue for Zimmerman's arrest. So the defense team filed a motion to compel Crump to produce the recording device and the original audio file. That's when a quiet bombshell was dropped, but only a few people noticed. A blogger from the Conservative Treehouse noticed a small footnote in the document. Remember how Benjamin Crump repeatedly stated that Trayvon's girlfriend Dee Dee was a minor that was 16 years old?
She is a minor?
She is a 16-year-old teenager.
Well, when she sat down with investigators to provide her statement just 2 weeks later, she had miraculously aged 2 years. In the filing, George Zimmerman's defense attorney stated in a footnote that Dee Dee, quote, is 18 years old and was 18 at the time of Mr. Crump's interview of her, end quote. The footnote goes on, quote, her age was edited out of the interview in a previous disclosure, end quote. How did she become 18 years old in less than 2 weeks? Why did the prosecutor edit out her age when they provided the interview to George Zimmerman's lawyer? And why was Benjamin Crump refusing to provide the original audio recording of his interview with Dee Dee? This was strange, but the trial would hint at the reason why. Opening remarks in the George Zimmerman trial commenced on June 24, 2013.
I think the evidence will show that this is a sad case, that there are no monsters here.
But it was on day three that the girl Benjamin Crump introduced as Trayvon Martin's girlfriend stepped up to the witness stand and began her testimony. Her name was Rachel Juntel, and her testimony was a train wreck.
One thing about
what Trayvon Martin told you that made you think this was racial?
Describing the person.
Pardon me?
Describing the person.
I just didn't...
Describing the person that was watching him and following him, sir.
Describing the person is what made you think it was racial?
Yes.
And that's because he described him as a creepy-ass cracker?
Yes.
So it was racial, but it was because Trayvon Martin put race in this?
No.
You don't think that's a racial comment?
No.
You don't think that creepy-ass cracker is a racial comment?
No.
She was argumentative, at times incoherent, and her statements were often inconceivably inconsistent. For example, in her initial recorded interview with Benjamin Crump, she claimed that when Trayvon first encountered Zimmerman, the phone cut off immediately.
Tell Trayvon, go home. And then he could be fall, and then I don't know what happened, the phone just shut off.
But in her sworn testimony 2 weeks later with the special prosecutor, she said Trayvon said get off after their initial interaction.
Well, what you told Mr. Crump was that you heard Trayvon Martin say, why are you following me? And then you heard Mr. Zimmerman say either, what are you talking about or what are you doing around here? And then you heard something that you described as sort of a bump and that the phone cut off. Right, so once the phone cuts off,
I call back.
There's nothing else that you have to say, correct? Because once the phone cuts off, you certainly can't hear anything else that might have been said because the phone had been disconnected.
Yes, sir.
Entirely new Trayvon statements were materializing, and they all oddly benefited the argument that Zimmerman was the aggressor. Rachel Jontel's testimony was so bad that not even ABC News could sugarcoat her performance.
What stood out in her testimony?
Well, the mere fact that at times it was almost incomprehensible stood out. There were some uncomfortable moments when even the jury was asking the witness to repeat herself. The judge had to say to the jury, you can't ask questions, just raise your hand if you can't understand. The defense counsel had to reposition themselves in the courtroom.
But perhaps the most revealing moment was when Rachel Jontel was asked to review a written letter she says she gave Trayvon's mother. During a deposition just a few weeks before the trial, Trayvon's mother pulled out a letter. She claimed that Rachel Jontel gave it to her. It was dated March 19, 2012, 3 weeks after Trayvon's death. It detailed what Rachel Jontel heard while on the phone with Trayvon in the moments before his death. But the letter was oddly signed Diamond Eugene. This letter was presented to Rachel Jontel during her trial testimony.
Are you unable to read that at all?
Some of them I do not.
Can you read any of the words on it?
I don't understand. Curses. I don't read curses.
Did you sign it at the bottom?
Yes.
What name did you use?
Diamond Eugene.
I'm sorry.
Diamond Eugene.
Diamond Eugene.
Diamond Eugene.
Are you saying that...
That's your name that you signed at the bottom?
Yes.
But it's not actually your name?
No.
That's a name that you made up?
That's my nickname.
But your last name isn't Eugene.
That's my mother.
Right, last so name. You signed it Diamond Eugene so as not to use your real name?
Yes.
Okay.
The whole thing was weird. How could she not read a letter that was supposed to be signed by her? And why did she sign it in a name that wasn't hers? And for that matter, why was she 16 years old when Benjamin Crump recorded her, but was miraculously 18 just 2 weeks later when she spoke to the special prosecutor? Within days after her testimony, others began to think the unthinkable, that Rachel Jontel was not the girl in Benjamin Crump's recording. A reporter named Christina Vasquez from the ABC News affiliate in South Florida suggested that Rachel Jontel was a fraud, reporting, quote, "There has been speculation that the woman in the recorded phone conversation was not her," end quote. In other words, there was possibly an imposter on the witness stand for one of the most consequential cases in recent American history. This may sound like the stuff of conspiracy theories, but it's not. Again, Joel Gilbert.
This case interested me because I identified it as kind of a turning point in American history, where this racial divide started with the Trayvon Martin case, the Zimmerman trial, And it was also kind of the turning point where the modern era of what we call fake news started, where the news would just go with a narrative despite all the evidence otherwise and continue to promote it.
It was all of the inconsistencies of Trayvon Martin's girlfriend that caught Joel's eye and ear.
I had recalled that when Benjamin Crump presented this phone call, the girl with the audio, I recall, sounded very different from the girl that showed up in court a year later, Rachel Gentel. Rachel Gentel was about 150 pounds heavier than Trayvon, 2 years older than him, and her story kept changing. And I started, went back and listened to the original phone call of Ben Crump that set off this entire narrative. And I listened to it many times, and I could tell right away it wasn't the same girl. So I said, you know what, I'm going to look into this case. And if I can identify the real girlfriend, find out why she was switched, who knew about it, and who switched her for Rachel Gentel, and why she was switched out, I'm going to find the girl. And if I can get her in my movie, I'm going to make a film about it. And I even decided to write a book about it that explained the whole case.
That book and movie are both titled The Trayvon Hoax, Unmasking the Witness Fraud That Divided America. And it's mind-blowing. Joel did something that apparently no other investigator has done. He proved without a reasonable doubt, in my opinion, that the girl on the witness stand was not Trayvon's girlfriend. She was also not the girl that Benjamin Crump recorded in his phone interview. Rachel Gentel was an imposter.
Anybody could have walked into the state of Florida archives like I did and gotten Trayvon's cell phone records, 750 pages. And guess what? He's texting pictures back and forth with Diamond Eugene with the girlfriend. It's not Rachel Gentel. You know, it's a different girl. So it was like 6 years later and nobody even thought to look into it because they didn't want to know. They didn't want to know that this entire thing was a hoax.
What Joel did to prove this was really an incredible example of investigative journalism that you could only truly appreciate by seeing his film, The Trayvon Hoax, and reading the book. He used high school yearbooks, Trayvon's phone records, social media accounts, arrest records, writing samples, audio files, and even DNA to prove that Rachel Gentel was not Trayvon's girlfriend. And if you examine the evidence closely, it becomes apparent, in my opinion, that Benjamin Crump, Trayvon's parents, and even the prosecution and an ABC News reporter all appeared to be in on it.
Had the media covered this properly and investigated, Benjamin Crump, I think, would have been in jail by now because he was in on switching the witnesses. Sabrina Fulton, Trayvon Martin's mother, who barely lost her election for Miami-Dade Commission by only 300 votes a few weeks ago, she was in on it. She knew the girl was a fake. And the father must have known, too, because he claimed later in his book, father admitted that he met Diamond Eugene prior to Rachel Gentel appearing on the scene. Matt Gutman, the ABC News correspondent, he spoke to her and texted her 72 times. So it's almost unbelievable that he wouldn't know the difference, that it was a different girl. And even the prosecutors, it's pretty clear. It's almost impossible that they would not have known that this was a fake witness. I think they were all in on it. And George Zimmerman actually filed a lawsuit in the state of Florida for civil conspiracy, fraud, and witness tampering against all of these people, including Rachel Gentel, Diamond Eugene, Trayvon's parents, the prosecutors, Ben Crump. And if that winds its way through the courts, which it's doing slowly, and he gets them under oath, I think, you know, it's all going to come out.
Why would they all allow a witness swap? Perhaps the age-old reason, money and power. After Benjamin Crump recorded the interview with Trayvon's actual girlfriend, Diamond Eugene, she backed out. But new evidence was needed to arrest George Zimmerman, so a witness was materialized. Enter Rachel Gentel. Her testimony may have lost the case, but the money still came in. Benjamin Crump secured a reported seven-figure settlement with Zimmerman's HOA. Trayvon's parents launched a foundation in their son's name that generated big bucks, they received a book deal, and signed a movie deal with Harvey Weinstein. And why would Benjamin Crump have risked so much for his client? Joel thinks he knows why.
Mark O'Mara, one of the attorneys for George Zimmerman, when I told him about the fake witness in the case, at first he was like, Well, how's that possible? Why would Ben Crump be involved in something like that? Why would he risk his law license to fake a witness? It's not worth it. And I later found out that he had a $106,000 federal tax lien.
A large fee from a settlement could easily pay off that lien and more. George Zimmerman's trial ended July 13, 2013.
State of Florida versus George Zimmerman. Verdict, we the jury find George Zimmerman not guilty. So say we all, foreperson.
In a familiar scene, Benjamin Crump made a statement after the verdict.
Tracy and Sabrina are thankful for all those prayers over the past 17 months since the death of their son. In conclusion, for Trayvon to rest in peace, we must all be peaceful.
Of course, the Trayvon protesters weren't peaceful.
Protests against Zimmerman's acquittal continue.
No justice!
Erupting from Los Angeles to Houston overnight.
There was also an attack. One person was sitting on a bus bench. We saw this guy just get violently attacked out of nowhere. He appeared to be injured. He was walked away by somebody.
Don't go near this area because there is still no police presence there, and a lot of people trying to get through that intersection have been assaulted with rocks and bottles and sticks.
Shortly after the verdict, the hashtag Black Lives Matter was created by a civil rights activist, and the seed of a new movement sprouted. The reaction to the Trayvon Martin verdict was loud and violent, but it lacked an essential ingredient to go nuclear. Trayvon's death did not come at the hands of law enforcement. That would come a little over a year later.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
No justice! No peace!
Protesters of different ages and races demanding answers in the shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown at the hands of a policeman.
Everybody is extremely mad at this. This is another Trayvon Martin story. A young man died before his time because of brutality from a different race. It's racial profiling.
And Benjamin Crump was there again with the family of the deceased.
We will demand equal justice for Michael Brown Jr.
Just like in the Trayvon Martin case, Officer Wilson was found to be justified in shooting Michael Brown. And also like the Trayvon Martin case, Benjamin Crump was able to extract a seven-figure payment for his clients, even though the shooter was acquitted. In fact, since the death of Trayvon Martin, Benjamin Crump has been busy. He represented the family of George Floyd, the man who died while being arrested by Minneapolis police with a lethal dose of fentanyl in his system.
We are expecting these officers to be charged as accomplices for the killing of George Floyd.
The family of George Floyd raked in nearly $15 million in crowdfunding donations after riots, burning, and looting swept through the nation. And that windfall will likely increase. Benjamin Crump also represents the family of Breonna Taylor, the woman who was shot by police during a drug raid on her Louisville, Kentucky apartment.
Morning. I'm not saying good because right now it is not a good morning for Breonna Taylor and the supporters of Breonna Taylor and her family. I'm attorney Ben Crump. We have the honor of representing and fighting for respect, dignity, and justice for Breonna Taylor.
There's clear evidence that Breonna was involved in her ex-boyfriend's illegal drug selling business. A dead body was found in her rental car, for God's sake. Violence erupted all across the nation when a grand jury decided not to charge the officers for Breonna's death. But Benjamin Crump still secured a $12 million settlement with the city of Louisville for Breonna's family. To add to that, the family took in nearly $7 million more and counting from a crowdfunding campaign. Benjamin Crump also represents the family of Jacob Blake, the accused rapist who was shot by police while foolishly breaking a restraining order and resisting arrest.
Well, when you look at that video, that horrific video that showed Jacob Blake Jr. being shot at least seven times at point-blank range, where the officer is holding his t-shirt and you see it on the video. Where is the humanity?
Protests, of course, erupted in Jacob Blake's hometown of Wisconsin as well. He has raked in over $2 million from donations. Benjamin Crump has been at the center of practically every one of these racially charged events, and riots and BLM bucks have followed. Which brings us back to the question, what does the Black Lives Matter movement want? The answer is simple, power and money. Supporters of Black Lives Matter are using the movement to gain power and cold hard cash. In the wake of George Floyd's death, over 171 Black Lives Matter affiliated organizations raised a massive flood of donations. Act Blue, the most popular donation platform for progressive causes, raked in $250 million in just 4 days, and the take was largely attributed to BLM. And it wasn't just individual donations.
2 weeks ago, we announced Apple's Racial Equity and Justice Initiative with a commitment of $100 million.
Walmart is committing $100 million over the next 5 years to build a racial equity center.
And that doesn't include funding funneling into Black Lives Matter-related films, books, curriculum, and affirmative action-based programs. The radical BLM movement has become so powerful that even Donald Trump has acquiesced to their pressure.
If you vote Republican over the next 4 years, we will create 3 million new jobs for the black community, increase access to capital in black communities by $500 billion.
The Black Lives Matter movement is not about ending police brutality or eliminating law enforcement or reforming systemic racism. No, BLM is simply a power grab. And it looks like an over 50-year-old tactic endorsed by the founder of the Black Power movement, the ones that started it all, has finally paid off.
A lot of people in the bourgeoisie tell me they don't like Rap Brown when he says I'm going to burn the country down. But every time Rap Brown says I'm going to burn the country down, they get a poverty program.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Inform Ventures. Now, our entire archive of episodes is only available to our Backstage subscribers. To subscribe, visit redpilledamerica.com and click support at the top of the menu. That's redpilledamerica.com and click support at the top of the menu. Thanks for listening.